Good afternoon. I am calling this meeting of the House Higher Education Committee to order. Sorry I'm late. I was in a constituent meeting. Welcome to everyone. We want to especially grateful to welcome Chair Marian Rarick back in person. It's a delight to have you. Thank you. All right. So this isn't the right. So first we'll take a look at the minutes from last meeting. Have you had a chance to review the minutes, Chair Scott?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have, and I would move the minutes.
Thank you, Chair Scott. We are Representative Coulter.
Sorry, Madam Chair, just a very, very small thing that I sincerely hope falls under the definition of technical. There is a typo on, it's near the top of the second page. There's a missing T in the word regents. Just wanted to make sure that folks were aware of that. I'm not like that. But it's under.
Could you say it again?
Near the top of the second page, House File 4413. Second full page, not the back of the first page.
Okay.
That's on me. There's a missing T.
Oh, thank you. What an eagle eye. Representative Coulter, very impressed.
Normally I am not like that, but I have time, I guess.
So, that's why he's the vice chair, Madam Chair.
So are you making an oral amendment to correct them?
You know what? I will. Why not? It's spring. I'm wearing my tan suit. Why not? So we'll add a T into the word regents.
Yes, represent.
Top of tech. It does say page 3 at the bottom. Thank you for that correction.
Thank you. So Representative Coulter makes an amendment to the minutes to add a T to the end of the word regents at the top of page 3 on the minutes from March 26th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And Chair Scott then moves the minutes as amended for approval. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. The minutes of March 26th are approved. Excellent. So first, we are going to now go through the bills. We have first up HF 4698 from Representative Duran. We will be laying this bill over. Representative Duran, you've brought your testifiers. Excellent. So Representative Duran moves HF 4698 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Duran, welcome to your committee. We look forward to hearing about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee members, for allowing me to present this bill today, HF 4698. This bill addresses critical challenges facing Minnesota State Colleges and Universities enrollment fraud. Every year, campus staff spends countless hours manually investigating applications to ensure that students claiming enrollment are who they are. Most process is time-consuming, costly, and can delay access to genuine students. More importantly, it leaves our institutions and our citizens vulnerable to identity theft. This bill proposes the implementation of an automatic identity proofing system, a secure technology based on framework and confirms the identity of students at the point of application. So it uses actually document verification, biometric checks, authoritative cross references, behavioral analytics, and the benefits of this would reduce enrollment fraud, less investigative workload for administrative staff and faculty, better allocations to campus resources, improved management and class waitlist, faster enrollment process, and protections for victims of identity theft. I would like to pass it over to Craig Munson to help kind of walk us through a little bit more about what this does.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Munson. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Craig Munson. I'm Chief Information Security Officer for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And I'd like to start off with thanking Representative Duran for introducing or bringing forward this bill that would allocate funding for an automated identity proofing system. Now, the funds requested would be used to purchase a commercial software-based system that largely automates our current manual identity verification processes all students must complete prior to enrollment. The funds would also go towards the staff needed to implement and configure and maintain the system across all 33 colleges and universities. As Representative Duran talked about briefly, there are a number of benefits for a system like this. First and foremost, we would see a significant reduction in instances of fraud. And how do we know this? Well, there are other colleges and universities that have implemented something very similar, and we've seen from their experiences a reduction of 50% in the first 2 weeks of going live, and then it continues to get better and better. And so we want to follow what our peers are doing. I would also see a reduction in the time spent in those investigative activities, and those are done by admission specialists, my team of cybersecurity specialists, faculty, and other folks that are spending time away from the job that they're hired to do, and they have to be, turn into folks that have to, look up databases and do that investigative work. With less time spent on those investigative activities, the resources can be better allocated. So also, less GO students taking up class space that was supposed to be for our real students means that we have better wait lists, and only real people are on those wait lists. And it also will give us better enrollment data for forecasting and estimations, and also estimations on faculty workload. We don't want to hire more instructors to instruct GO students. There would be a faster enrollment process for our students, so it's a benefit for them because they don't have to wait for their identities to be manually validated. And then finally, this would provide a reduction in harm for anybody that is a victim of identity theft. As we know, most of the identities being used are by real citizens to enroll in at our institutions that they didn't intend to, because again, their identities were stolen. And some of these victims are our own Minnesota citizens, so it'd be a benefit to them as well. So I do appreciate the opportunity to talk about the most effective way to enhance and modernize our anti-fraud measures at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Okay. Any member questions or discussion? Oh, Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you very much. And, I'm all about making sure that we prevent fraud. And I'm really excited about the idea of reducing harm due to identity theft. But the second I heard the word biometrics, my skin went a little tingly. What type of biometrics are you collecting in this system?
Representative Cleaborn, thank you for the question. The biometrics would be an image of the person, so they would take a selfie, and then they would also submit a picture of their state-issued ID, the front and the back,
okay. And
then the AI would take a look and compare all of those things, because it's hard to replicate all of those things together and pretend you're somebody who you aren't.
Perfect.
Chair Cleaborn.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Just to make sure that we're all on the same page, so it's not like the airport where you scan your eye or anything like that. It's just the picture of the ID, and it's not a funny question, it's a serious question. Because identity theft is real, and the most important thing you have is your identity, and so I wanna make sure that we're not enabling systems that are gonna be collecting a lot of biometric data like that on individuals. So if it's, a selfie that isn't like taking images of somebody's retina, I'm okay with that, but if you're taking more detailed images, then I have a problem with it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Cleaborn. And I share your concerns. The biometric data privacy is very important to me as well. Could you tell us, Mr. Munson, where is this, even the selfies and the IDs, where is it stored? And what sort of protections would the vendor have around protecting that data?
Representative Robbins and Representative Cleaver, thank you for the question. We would not be collecting any fingerprint data. We would not be collecting any retinal scans. the images, that would be an agreement between us and the vendor. It would be protected data under our own cybersecurity classifications and our state statutes as well. We would ensure that all protections would be on board to make sure that no one would have access to the data that is not authorized. I myself am a big privacy advocate. I do not believe in sharing data outside of anybody that has a business need and a legitimate need to use it. So I also share your same concerns.
Chair Cleburne. Thank you. And to that end, I would like to see, I understand we're laying this over for today, but if this language moves out of committee, we really need to have Chapter 13 protections in the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Chair Scott wants to address the Chair 13.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My question to the testifier is, how long do they keep those images stored? Do they, like, after 6 years, after the kid's not in college anymore, do they still need, what's that process?
Mr. Monson.
Representative Scott, I believe that we would want to delete them as quickly as possible. It may be immediate, depending on the system. So we have no interest in holding on to data for anything other than necessary to say that this person's validated. We don't need to have the image after that. We can just say it's gone as soon as they're validated.
Chair Scott.
Yeah, thank you. And I was just thinking maybe in terms of, if they are a returning student, do they have to go through the process again? It makes me super happy if you're not keeping it at all. Trust me, it makes me really happy, and then it's less vulnerable, right, for hacking. So that was just kind of one of my questions.
Thank you, Chair Scott. Mr. Monson, did you want to respond?
Yes, Chair, Representative Scott. We probably would want to remove it, and because normally if you think about students, they can have their identity stolen as well after they come into our great institution. So maybe yearly or every 2 years, they may revalidate themselves and they would submit a new image. So I don't really see any reason why we'd need to hold on to it.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you. You may or may not have an answer to this, but it is something I have a question about. We know biometric data is disproportionately not great at matching the faces of people of color. And so I'm curious if we have any ideas about how to ensure that accuracy, if you're having any metrics there available for that. And if you're discarding the information right away, I'm not advocating to keep it, to be clear. But how would you identify if this known issue with biometrics happens to an applicant that is maybe not verified because of the failures of the software?
Mr. Monson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Hansen, I also share your concern in that space. I do know that the most recent numbers we've had is for identifying people, it is not perfect amongst different backgrounds of folks. It's 98% for a white male like myself. It goes down into the 60s percentages for people of different skin color than mine. We are looking to make sure that the image matches the selfie matches the picture, not identifying that the person is on some other area or some other data source. So it's a little bit different. We do know that the technologies are improving. We will have alternate ways of identifying yourself as well, because we know no system is ever perfect, and we will make sure that it is not a hardship for any student to do the alternate ways as well.
Representative Hansen. Excellent. Thank you. Representative Rarick. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is about the scope of the fraud. If you could speak to how many dollars you think have been stolen and maybe how many actors there were.
Mr. Monson.
Chair Robbins, Representative Rarick, we have discussed this in caucus privately. We don't want to give too much information to the public because the fraudsters may see some of this information as well, so we don't really want to say how effective they are. What I can say is the dollars spent on this bill would be less than what we're spending on paying the salaries of the individuals that are spending some of their time doing this work, and also of the dollars that have been lost to fraud as well.
Thank you. Representative Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I had read in a news article that it was at that time about $12 million. Just to put that out there, that's already in the news. I don't know if it's above that or below that or for what time frame. Let me ask you this. Do you have a sense as to how long you think that this ghost student issue has been happening?
Mr. Munson.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Representative Rarick, we have seen ghost students in some form or fashion over the last decade. We have seen an increase in ghost students over the last 2 to 3 years. I did see the $12 million. We don't know where that those figures came from. Our numbers are much less than that. And also, that is all colleges and universities, including private and other forms throughout the state of Minnesota, was that number, not just directly at Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Thank you. Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the last thing is, the state of Minnesota institutionally has basically a verification of identification, and it was rolled out and made prominent with paid family leave. So I'm wondering, have we had this conversation about possibly using that system? Why do you need your own unique system? Is it a very similar vendor? If you could just kind of go down that road with us.
Mr. Munson.
Representative Rarick, we could look at, we are in the phase right now, because we have not identified our funding yet. We are always open to working with other organizations and individuals that if they have a system that's working. Right now we're in the evaluation process. We've been working with several different vendors, well-known ones that have been used by the state of California and other organizations. So we are in that phase right now. As far as working with the state of Minnesota is who you referenced, we would be open to talk with the state and see what system they're using to make sure it works with our diverse population of students.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you. Yeah, very specifically DEED. So on the fraud committee, we had DEED come in front of us and talk about their measures of preventing fraud and paid family leave. And they were very explicit about very similar technology that you're talking about now, the identification, and they felt that that was going to be a big part of preventing fraud. So that's where I was referring to, specifically with Indeed and the paid family leave program that was just launched, that they're doing the identification verification. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you. Thanks for the bill, and I think this sounds like a really good idea, but I also just kind of want to go back to some of the conversation around the data and where it's going to go. And I just would like to add to it that I would like to see the bill a little bit more fleshed out on that too. It would make me a lot more comfortable to be a little bit more explicit. I don't know if it would just refer to Chapter 13, but you know, when I hear AI, I always worry that the AI companies are always training on the data we put in there. And so it does, you know, I just think we need to be a little bit careful. Obviously, the committee is sharing that concern. So the other question I have is about the money here. It's in the bill. It's $1.5 million in fiscal year 27. So is it contemplated that there wouldn't be any ongoing appropriation for this? Maybe, I don't know if the Representative Duran can answer, or Mr. Munson. You know, it says for acquisition, obviously that's one time, implementation, support, and maintenance. So maintenance makes me think, and surely you can't just buy it once and then never have to do, you know, it's, the costs are just one time. So have you kind of thought about how that might work, or are we then gonna, you know, have it just go into somebody's budget and be absorbed, or what's the thinking there?
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Lieberman, for that. And I think this is a good start for us to kind of figure out how much this is actually going to cost us and what that figure is going to be. Right now, I think this is a realistic number that we can all live with for a starting point, and then kind of assess as we go further down the line to make sure that we're keeping up to par with what the costs are going to be. I don't know if Mr. Munson here has anything else to say about the cost of these things for finances here. We can maybe look at this in the future, but I think this is a good start for us.
Mr. Munson.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, this would be an annual cost for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. We would still need to keep our staff trained up on that system, make the configuration changes. Again, the attackers change their tactics about every 6 months or so, so it'll need to be tweaked by ourselves and the vendor. And then also they typically charge a per application dollar amount, and we have about 360,000 applications that come into our systems every year.
Chair Liebling.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And so, you know, so just to be clear, I think you're saying we could expect to hear a request for ongoing, but maybe to Representative Duran's point, we'll have a little better picture of how well it's working and so on. I mean, I do think it sounds like something we should do. And it sounds like it'll pay for itself, and it's not just the dollars, as was pointed out, you know, with, you know, staff time. And for so many reasons, we need to crack down on this as tightly as we possibly can. But, you know, just to be clear that there will be some ongoing request for this. It's not going to be once and done.
Thank you. Chair Levine, are you finished?
Yes, thank
you. Okay, and I would like to turn to Mr. Savory because he has some insight for us. Thank you.
Chair and members, as a point of information, the bill as drafted would be an ongoing base increase to Minnesota State. So there is no, from my understanding, one-time language that would allow this to fall off. Should the committee and the legislature enact this, it would show up in the base in the next session when the committee would determine the next biennial budget.
Thank you, Mr. Savory. Any further comment, Chair Liebling?
Thanks. Well, thank you for clarifying that, because I think that's important to understand. It's just a bit different, just, you know, given all the pressures that we have. But I persist in thinking this is an important thing to do. But thank you.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. Any other questions? Okay, I would add my agreement with Chair Liebling that I think this is important. And I think after we do the initial appropriation in a future fiscal note, we'll be able to see what the savings are from this, so that maybe we understand more the budget implications, but clearly the ghost student problem is a vector of fraud that we need to get a handle on. So we appreciate you bringing this. Any closing comments, Representative Duran?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you guys for the conversations. And I will look into the data practices to make sure that we get it to where we all feel comfortable with this. And, you know, working with Chair Liebling and Chair Scott in regards to making sure that we carve this into something that both sides are in agreement on. And I appreciate the work that we will have in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. With that, Representative Duran renews his motion to lay over HF 4698. Next up, we have HF 4608. Which is a bill authored by Representative Kosnick, who has a different bill going on. So Representative Allen is going to stand in for him and present the bill. So as a member of the committee, Representative Allen can move the bill. So Representative Allen moves HF 4608, which will be laid over. Representative Allen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chair Wolgamont, for hearing the bill, HF 4608. This is an opportunity. I appreciate having the opportunity to be able to present this bill before you. At its core, this bill is about transparency, efficiency, and student success. Right now, too many students in Minnesota's higher education system are being placed into developmental or remedial courses that do not count towards their degree. According to the data highlighted by stakeholders, a majority of the students in developmental education never complete their credential. Students can spend months, even years, taking courses that don't move them towards graduating. In 2023 alone, over $1 million was spent on credits that don't count towards a degree or real jobs. Even more concerning, many students don't realize this is happening until they've already invested a lot of time and a lot of money. And research shows that these students who avoid developmental education altogether are twice as likely to complete their degree. What I will do at this time is I'm going to turn the mic over to my testifier to fill us a little bit more in on the bill.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Jane Grotman. I'm the executive director at the International Institute of Minnesota.
Please begin. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Robbins and Chair Rarick, and I want to thank Representative Allen for introducing our bill today. The International Institute of Minnesota has provided services for 106 years to new Americans in our community. One of the key services we provide is helping clients advance their careers through on-site career pathways that help increase their wages and sustain their families. We have trained and employed over 4,000 clients in healthcare, with over 800 of these graduates reaching their lifetime goal of becoming a nurse, most of them reaching their four-year RN degree. In this work, we have long-standing partnerships with many community colleges and other colleges where we refer many students and work jointly to better serve our community and our students. So during the process of helping our clients advance into nursing degrees, we discovered that they were referred to developmental education courses, remedial reading, writing, and math, where they could spend a year or 5 years in classes that charge for credits that do not count toward their college degree or certifications. Several years ago, a client was referred to our medical careers program. She had spent 4 years in developmental education, taking ESL, remedial reading, writing, and listening classes, and was still enrolled in those classes when we met her. She had accumulated 59 credits of developmental education, and she was confused about why she wasn't graduating from her nursing program that was a 40-credit program. Also, she did not understand that these credits would not count towards her college degree and that she was now out of financial aid because for 8 semesters, she had not received college credit-bearing classes. When we had to tell her that the credits she accumulated did not count towards her degree, she was distraught and heartbroken. So this is one story of many stories that we could share with you. We now counsel our students on alternative free preparation for college that exists in our community, which has greatly increased their chances of graduating from college. So in this bill, we propose capping the time students can spend in remedial courses of any kind to 1 semester, and that students are informed that the credits they're taking in Dev Ed do not count towards their degree, even though they are paying for them either out of their own pocket or with their Pell Grant. The Office of Higher Education, in their Getting Prepared report published in 2025, states, and I quote, "When looking at four-year completion rates of high school graduating students from the class of 2019, students who do not enroll in developmental education complete their post-secondary education at double the rate of students who do enroll in developmental education. This pattern has been consistent with previous high school graduating classes and is true regardless of sector," end of quote. So in other words, if you do not attend developmental education, you double your chances of graduating from college. I am pleased to report that there has been progress in this area. Student enrollment in developmental education is down by 75% from 2018. With this reduction in remedial course enrollment, college graduation rates have not been impacted, demonstrating what local and national research shows, that students can compensate for any academic deficits that they have, just like I had to do when I went to college. If students are not ready, there are college preparation programs that are effective and free for students that can help them prepare to be ready for college. And those programs in the community could scale up to serve more people if needed. So community colleges are very important institutions to the Institute, to our work, to our students, and to employer partners, and to the community. They are vital for people to advance their wages, which we all want, so that students can advance into nursing degrees and to other degrees so that they then can get a higher wage and support their family. We believe these measures proposed in this bill will help improve those student graduation rates. Thank you.
Thank you. And is there another testifier? Mr. Grant? Yes. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. Good to see you, Chair Eric. Chair Walgamott, thank you so much. For the record, my name is Mark Grant. I'm a communication instructor at Dakota County Technical College, and I currently help assist in the governmental relations work on behalf of Minnesota State College faculty. I want to thank you for the opportunity to just share a couple of thoughts on House File 4608. I want to start by saying that we understand and share some of the concerns that are expressed in this bill, evident by the fact that our faculty have been working with the system office to address many of these issues over the past 3+ years. We also do not have an issue with co-requisite developmental courses. They exist on many of our campuses, and some of our faculty are amongst their biggest proponents. Our concern tends to be that this bill looks to limit the approaches to DevEd by imposing a one-size-fits-all model to all of our institutions, and by extension, the diverse student population each one of those institutions serve. Simply put, the developmental education needs in Thief River Falls tend to be quite different than those found at Minneapolis College. And anytime you mandate a single approach, you will meet the needs of some students, but you will inevitably leave some students behind. Fundamental to our mission is to meet every student where they're at and get them where they need to be. And this bill's requirement that colleges must refer any student who does not meet the minimum criteria for enrollment to free college preparation programs strikes at the heart of that mission. This required referral would effectively create admission standards at our institutions and end our status as open access institutions. Without being flippant, we already know what works. Small classes that target specific developmental needs with significant student support, but that is really, really expensive. From IIMN's own literature, tuition-free education programs that support learners from college preparation through graduation have been shown to be effective alternatives to developmental ed. We would agree. And if you would like me to write the bill to make developmental education tuition-free for the student, or a bill to reverse the trend of our institutions losing 60% of our faculty counselors over the past 15 years, I can have drafts in your inbox by this afternoon. But limiting the tools of the professionals who create and deliver this curriculum is not the approach that we think should be taken. Thank you, and I'll answer any questions if I can.
Thank you. Is there any member discussion? Chair Liebling, you can go first, and then we'll get the rest on the list.
Yeah, thank you, and thanks. It's good for us to think about this issue. I just was, and I don't know a lot about this. You know, I've said a number of times, this is my first term on the higher ed committee, and I'm just learning about some of these topics. But I was just struck by the statement, if you don't attend developmental ed, you double your chance of graduating from college. I don't know if this testifier intended it to sound like there was something causal there, that somehow attending developmental ed made you less likely to graduate. I think if that was the intent, it doesn't make any sense because you're not comparing the same students. You know, it's not an experiment where you're starting with people who are on the same playing field, right? So you're talking, if people need developmental education, they're starting from behind. So I just found that statement a little bit mind-boggling and just, but you know, glad we're having the conversation, and it's one that, you know, we certainly need to wrestle with, you know, making sure that we educate students the best way to get them to reach their goals in the least amount of time and at the least cost for them. And so thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Do you care to comment, Ms. Grupman?
Please, thank you. I'm Representative Liebling. That wasn't my quote. I was quoting from the Office of Higher Education. That was their report. That wasn't my quote. And I would just say from the reading that I've done that there's a lot of national reading organizations that have studied this issue. And what it shows is that that students who get in a protracted number of classes in developmental education drop out because they have families, they're low income, they thought their nursing program was going to take 2 years, and they've already been in college for 3 years or 2 years, and they don't understand why they're not moving ahead. And what the research also shows that they also can compensate, many students can compensate for deficits they have. So I think it's really the length of time, and that's why we're proposing the one semester.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Chair Liebling? Okay, thank you. Representative Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, as I read this bill, I think the first piece, the providing clear written explanations, I think that is a really, really important piece. I think many of you know I'm the son of a community college instructor. And so I've heard for many years some of the concerns and challenges about about what students do and do not know about the kind of education that they are getting. I also happen to be the husband of an adult basic education instructor. And so I think where I have a little bit of issue with this requirement to refer students to adult basic education, just because, you know, knowing as I do, that's not the same as college prep, right? Adult basic ed is sometimes, I mean, it's very, very basic English and math and life skills, and that's not the same as college prep. And so I think if we're concerned about making sure that students are, prepared to go into college, I don't know that requiring referral to adult basic ed is the way to go. The question I have, though, I think, and maybe you said this and I just missed this, I'm curious, the one semester limit, and both about that piece in terms of why only one semester, and then why English only? Why not math, for example?
Yeah, Ms. Grutman.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm not proposing it as English only. I would like to respond first to the comment about adult basic education. It is true not all adult basic education is the same, and not all of them do college prep, but there are programs in ABE that do provide very serious college prep and that have data. We have one program, the Hub Center has a program. We've been doing it for quite a long time. And so I think there are some programs that could be expanded in the community that are often paid for by, you know, private funding or some public funding that match that. So I think that would be effective from a financial standpoint. But I'm not proposing it's only English. I think one of the things that the adult basic education programs provide that's different than developmental education is that reading and writing and listening are integrated in the teaching. They're not four separate courses, you know, three separate courses. And so I think that can be effective in a semester if you integrate the classes. And I know some community colleges have started that approach as well.
Thank you. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to clarify here, looking at the bill on its lines 2.6 and 2.7, refer to an adult basic education program for foundational skill development. I read that as not being the same as college prep. That's the only point I was making there. But in the English only, I'm referring to lines 2.3 and 2.4, where it's a one semester co-requisite, that's not such an easy word to say, co-requisite model for English courses. And so I'm wondering why is that the case only for English, not for math or other things sort of foundational to college education?
Ms. Grutman.
Yes, thank you. Because I think it's an example of one, and it's English class for students that are new Americans and other students. That's a class in colleges that it can have a low passing rate, those classes, and they're really a gateway course for people moving on into their college degree. So I think that is a class that we see that students struggle with. So that was the class that we've featured in the bill.
Vice Chair Coulter.
Yeah, I'll try and come in for a landing here. As the son of a math teacher, I would also point out that math is often in a similar place here. The last thing that I just wanted to raise is it's on line 2.1, this requirement for a written acknowledgement that students would have to sign a written acknowledgement. I understand the intent there in terms of, you know, we want to make sure that students understand what we tell them. I worry that sort of creates kind of an unnecessary sort of administrative hurdle. Particularly for students who may be working, who may be going to community and technical colleges and so on. And I just think maybe there's a better way to get at what I know you're trying to get at there. So, thank you.
Did you care to respond?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Representative Cleborne.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you for being here today. I appreciate the intent of what you're trying to do. I hear you clearly say that you want individuals to have a path for future, and you don't want them to go largely in debt when the outcome is not going to achieve their goal. That's what I'm hearing you, your desire. My concern, and I'll tell you where it comes from, I've been twice very fortunate to live outside of the country, and I know that there is an intellectual capability, and I know there's a language capability, right? So while I could do really great things in English, I couldn't always do great things in French or Portuguese, right? And so it takes a while for you to receive the facilities that you need to communicate in a new language and a new culture. That's what I'm getting at. So the cap of one semester actually gives me pause, because the individual may live near one of our wonderful state community colleges or universities, and if we're only capping, if we're capping them at one available semester, it might be their plan, their individual plan. They know what they're going to need. They might need a second semester. They might need a third semester. And if we put this into statute, does that block them then from receiving any kind of state aid to receive the education that they have planned for themselves? Do you understand what I'm saying or getting at? Okay. And so I really have trouble with the one semester cap. And then to my colleagues, the English course question is really an important one, because they may wish to do something else. And so to say that it would be a college level English course that they would be required to do, it might be a different need that they have. They might want to do something else. So I'm trying to make it more centered on the students' needs, not on just financial. Does that make sense? All right, thank you.
Ms. Grubman.
Thank you. Representative Cleavorn, I would just respond to that by saying, in terms of language development, English language development for people that are born outside of the U.S., Minnesota has a very robust English language programming in the community and across the state. We're very fortunate in the state, and it really makes a huge difference in people's abilities to move up into higher paying jobs and to get jobs in the first place. So I think there really is an existing robust program for that, for learning English language. So I think that exists already in the community. If people are concerned about the English course in this example, I think that's a need that we might see, and we just know that the English class at colleges has a low passing rate, and it's a hard student class for students to pass. So that is an example of where a co-requisite might work. I also do just think that it's important to be careful with co-requisite also, that they're not becoming protracted developmental education models, also where people are taking a lot of co-requisite classes that then that prevent them from graduating as well.
Thank you. Chair Cleavorn.
No, I would just say thank you. I truly appreciate the intent of what you're trying to do to help students. It's a really complicated issue, right? So thank you for being with us today.
Thank you. And the gentleman who approached the table, did you want to speak to this question? So this, or are you waiting for the?
I do have a comment from the Office of Higher Education.
Yes, so we would like to welcome you to the committee. Then we will go back to member questions. I don't want you to think we're disrespecting you. I saw him sitting there. I wanted to make sure you got your discussion, and please welcome to the committee and state your name. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. My name is Andrew Wald. I'm General Counsel and Director of Compliance at the Office of Higher Education. Nice to see you, Representative Rarick. I do have a concern or two around the office's responsibilities in this bill. The office doesn't currently have any authority, regulatory or curriculum around public institutions in the state. So there would probably need to be some sort of amendment to our regulatory authority under 136A01. And we did testify on the Senate version of this bill. We did also provide a fiscal note to the Senate. We don't currently have a curriculum specialist who would be able to provide these sort of guidelines or technical assistance to institutions, and would probably not be able to absorb that under current staffing because we don't have the expertise. So if this were to be placed as a responsibility of the institutions, then they may have the expertise to do so. If it is going to remain with the Office of Higher Education, then we would probably need to hire an education consultant. Three level is what we put in our fiscal note for the Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Wold. And just to Representative Allen and Representative Koznick, when he watches the tape, and to our testifier, you know, if you want to proceed with this, please be working with OHE to make sure that we're aligning everything properly. Thank you. Chair Verrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I heard you say one, and so I kind of know what one FTE within state government is for cost, but can you just clarify, and can you just let us know what the fiscal note was in the Senate? You said it was prepared for the Senate.
The dollar amount?
Mr. Wolf.
Sorry. Thank you, Chair. $146,000.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right, and then we're going to backtrack to Chair Cleavorn because she has a question for Mr. Wolf.
I do. Thank you. So also then with the reporting part of this bill, do you already have, would you have the information that you would need to set up this type of website and dashboard, I guess is the right word to use?
Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Cleavorn, there would be a cost for the reporting as well, and I think that was estimated around $13,000 in the Senate version. The data collection required for this would require some other modifications under, I think, Chapter 13, and we do have the ability to do that with our research unit. So I already talked about the cost. I think that we would be able to under current staffing.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. Moving back to Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Chair. I had a question about the reporting as well, and I don't know, maybe this speaks to the intent of the bill for the bill author's proxy, I guess. I see the reporting is asking just for the number of students. I just imagine we get a report and it just has three groups with numbers on it. What is the expectation for what this committee could extrapolate from that without, you know, mentioning like where the students are from, what campuses, if there's a trend there? I just wanted to make sure I kind of understood the purpose, especially if there's going to be a fiscal note with it. Thanks.
Representative Allen or your testifier.
Yeah, I think the intent of the reporting is just, and I would just say that the Office of Higher Education does incredible reporting. They have this report that I referred to. It's right here. It's incredibly thorough. There's so many data points about developmental education and about higher education and graduation rates. It's really impressive and very enlightening. So we just put it in just to call attention to the so people could see the results of what we're proposing.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. All right, Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much. So this is a unique interest area of mine, and when I was in my 20s, and I was helping students with disabilities transition into college. I was working in a transition program that was literally designed for kids with disabilities. And we had adult higher ed and we had developmental classes, and I was perplexed by why we were picking one over the other. And so I had one opinion back then. And then as I've sort of progressed in my thinking, I have really sort of come to the conclusion that people need to understand what's happening. So I really like the first part of this bill, that they need to understand what they're agreeing to. They need to understand that it doesn't count for credit because so many people don't. But also, the other thing I've learned is that sometimes those placement tests, it doesn't matter how much information someone knows, depending on their disability and depending on their needs, those placement tests are just going to continue to be a barrier. And so the ability to pass a developmental course in lieu of a placement test, I saw so many young people go on to finish their diplomas and finish their careers because of that piece. And so I'm very conflicted about this bill because I see the good pieces, particularly, and what you're trying to do. And I really do think the education piece is huge. Like, I want to be really clear. That is something that I am 100% behind. But I'm concerned about it always having to come back to the test and really having no other way for people to demonstrate skills and knowledge but the test. That, because we have a lot of community and technical college programs that aren't based on tests. They're based on skills. They're based on demonstrations, hands-on pieces. I think of our CNA tests, which a lot of people can pass the hands-on, but they have to take that written one, two, three, four times, right? I don't want someone's future to even get into the program to be based on a test. So I don't actually have a solution for that, which is why I've never brought a bill to address it, because I can't figure out how to do it. But I like that we're talking about it, and I'm hopeful that we can move maybe portions of this and have further conversations about ways to look through the other pieces.
Thank you. We need to move on, so final comments. Representative Allen.
Yes, thank you for taking the time to be able to listen to the bill today. Just for your information, it's gone through the Senate at this point in time. It was laid over there, and I'm sure the author would be amenable to any changes that we would need to be made. But the bill itself was laid over in the form that you're currently looking at it at. So just for your information, members. So thank you.
Oh, yes, Chair Barrick.
Thank you. Before we close, I'm listening very intently. And so when we put together our omnibus bill or mini omnibus bill or one bill or whatever it is that we're going to put together, I'm listening intently to the concerns. I just want you to know that. And I had some of those same concerns. I won't go through them all because you all did a very just an amazing job articulating that. So thank you. I'm really appreciative to all of the conversation that we've had on these bills. So all the way from Chair Liebling all the way to Chair Wolgamott, the whole breadth. So thank you. We will take all those things into consideration if we take any of the pieces possibly into the bill. And Representative Hicks, thank you. That was like the cherry on top, that last thing that you said. So thank you. We're listening. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. With that, HF 4608 will be laid over. Next, thank you very much. Next, we want to invite up Dr. Burr from CFANS, who is going to give us a discussion of regenerative farming. And this is an informational hearing, and we look forward to this update. Dean Burr. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Robbins. I'm Brian Boer. I'm Dean of the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Thank you for the invitation, and I want to appreciate Representative Rarick for suggesting and requesting a comment or some remarks about our work in regenerative agriculture. And so thank you all for that opportunity. This is a significant part of our research program. We have a slide deck here, but we're having trouble with, I think, the slideshow part of it is not coming up for us. So it'll be small, but I wanted to try and help keep on track through our slide deck of where we're at with it. And I put this first slide in here just for some characterization about agriculture and food production in general. And on this is a map of the U.S., and we have currently 140 million acres that we've lost in U.S. cropland over the last 40 years. And the point of that is mainly this issue that we really do need to sustain our cropland availability. A lot of that loss of cropland is due to development issues, highways, housing, numerous things that go on, landscapes. So we're continuously trying to advance our productivity. How do we get more food, more biofuels, more bio products from that land acreage? And in Minnesota, as you look at Minnesota, we now have 19.3 million acres of farmland in Minnesota. The total acreage in Minnesota, a trivia question if you happen to need it sometime, is about 51 million acres. And historically, that has been shrinking as well. And if you look at that bottom, which is hard to see on the slides when you're thinking, we've essentially across the U.S. lost 7 Minnesotas, to put it in perspective, of farmland in the U.S. over the last 40 years. So, A, we need to be highly productive and efficient in how we utilize that land, and B, we need to be very careful about how do we continue the sustainability of cropping systems on that land. There is such a thing as land exhaustion, and so regenerative agriculture is that piece of how do we prevent the loss of land from our cropping systems themselves as we're putting more and more intensity into those lands. And so it really is a critical, this question that's raised today that we're talking about is really critical to our future success as a ability to both feed fuel and provide bioproducts for our citizens and communities. This is another version of that. It just shows that this is kind of my, this shows the value of that, the research and innovation that we do at the University of Minnesota. And on the left-hand side of that is an image of our current land use in Minnesota. And you can see in northeast Minnesota across our forested lands that are part of that, and the rest of that is related to cropping systems. And it gives you a sense of what our landscape looks like in Minnesota. If you look to the right-hand side, you see those forested lands are gone there. And that essentially represents, we did a sort of a counterfactual. What would the world be like if we didn't have research and innovation in agricultural technologies? And the land use requirement for that would be all of Minnesota to get to the level we're at, plus about, I think it's around 6 million acres of Canada we'd need to have come into our systems to get that same level of production. So at the bottom line, it's this trade-off always we're working on in our work is how do we advance productivity, the amount of product we get from the land, and how do we, again, sustain that land? And the best way to sustain an ecology or the nature of the land is to not put the land into agriculture. The more we can have natural landscapes, the better off we are as a planet for the services that provides. So we're constantly in this conversation about how do we advance that productivity, how do we sustain our landscape, and that's where regenerative agriculture is such a huge opportunity for us as we're moving into the research we do. We have as a country and as a world really excelled at advancing productivity growth. The question is how do we do that in a way that can sustain those landscapes? For Minnesota, has huge opportunities, of course. One is we're always looking to feed a growing population, provide proper nutrition to people, assuring their healthy outcomes. It certainly supports Minnesota's communities, the economics of our communities, the development of our communities, as part of the business that is agriculture, and we're certainly committed to those efforts. And we turn research into real-world solutions. Oftentimes we do work in Dr. Jungers will be talking soon. He's a person who has more expertise in agronomy than I'll ever have as an economist working in this area. But we're always looking at how can we turn those into solutions that farmers can use that makes them profitable, that assures they have health themselves in their operation systems, and bringing those conservation natural resources along with that, that all of our farmers are concerned about how we maintain the health of our landscapes. And then finally, which we often don't think about with agriculture, but the principal issue in health and nutrition today, one of the principal issues is proper nutrition and the ability of high-quality, safe foods to consumers so that they can have healthy lives with that. And regenerative ag, as we look at it, and we'll talk more about what exactly that is as we go forward, is key. I'll just talk about the University of Minnesota's role in regenerative agriculture. And a key part of that is it does require, when you think about ecosystems and the interconnection between different living forms and different processes. We talk about business ecosystems and so on. One of the things with regenerative agriculture, it does require us to look at everything from soil health to water quality to environmental and climate aspects to the types of cropping systems to what's on that landscape and tie that together, the engineering solutions that come with that. And as a university, we're kind of that one-stop shop to bring that all together in a way that creates the opportunity for regenerative ag. I will point out that we work a lot with the private sector and significant members of the private sector, agribusinesses in the Twin Cities broadly. And one of the things we bring to them is that portfolio and platform to be able to think about these broader issues that many of them, I jokingly say this with all respect to General Mills, General Mills isn't a soil scientist enterprise. They do a great job with food and trying to generate healthy foods. We work on soils and what that means when they're developing crops and bringing health to that ecosystem. And so we work with them, for example, on some of these programs, just as one example. And finally, we catalyze business scale delivery. And I mentioned again, many of you are probably familiar with Greater MSP. They have a new initiative. It's actually been around for about 10 years now in total length that I was part of it at its start of that. And now they have an MBOLD, which is looking at how do we take these novel crops, these regenerative ag systems, and bring those out into business and get them put on the landscape and into the business practices so they can scale up into what we're doing. And we have the capability, again, to help lead that effort to do that work. How we do that, this is just a sense that oftentimes, and the CFANS is on the University of Minnesota St. Paul campus, but we have 10 research and outreach centers and extension offices in every county of the state that, again, take the research that we're doing in regenerative agriculture, get that out and educate it educationally for farmers and businesses and so on so they can take what we're developing and move that onto the landscape so it can have an impact, because these are landscape level issues of how do we manage our water resources and our land resources. And we do that through a network of research and outreach centers called our Long-Term Agricultural Research Network, where we take some of these new ideas, and one of those that Dr. Jungers may talk about is relay cropping. So for example, you take a winter annual crop that you actually plant in the fall. It goes dormant over the winter and then comes back to life in the spring as we thaw. So if you come over to St. Paul campus, and you're always welcome to come and visit our fields here in the heart of the Twin Cities, you'll see right now there's green crops out on that field, and those are crops that are regenerative, maintaining the soil in place, starting to generate already nutrients from those soils. And eventually what we'll do in the summer is plant soybeans, perhaps, into camelina, for example. So the farmer's getting a crop from camelina, plant soybeans, they get soybean crop from that, helps the farmer's profitability, helps retain the soil quality from that early generation of growing material on that landscape. And we're doing that across Minnesota, which is not an easy thing to do because northern Minnesota is colder than southern Minnesota, and you need the time of that you can plant crops to be able to bring those both to completion. And we're working on research to do that across Minnesota to support all the different landscapes that are there. We're certainly looking at soil health and soil fertility along with this. One of our greatest resources in Minnesota are natural prairies that we had historically really developed deep, rich soils. And we want to maintain those soils. It is the core of every farmer's livelihood is having healthy soils and trying to keep those in a system that regenerates itself, soil is a living entity. There are microorganisms in it, whether it's plants or it's microbiomes, it's worms, for example. They're all part of those healthy soils and help to sustain that. We bring solutions not only to rural Minnesota, but we look at controlled environment agriculture, which is growing in Minnesota, where you're growing indoor crops and doing that effectively as part of regeneration. You're not using as much of the landscape to do that work in multiple systems. And we're certainly, one of the key pieces is, can you bring these new crops that we're developing to market? And that's a place where, again, we're working with business and industry to identify new uses for that. And I'll come back to the value of the University of Minnesota is we work literally from the soil science, and our food science and nutrition program works at taking new and novel crops to food ingredients and food products for communities. And it requires that full spectrum of research to do that work. We're working with private sector companies as well as government and industry, others to do that work. And we really do view this as bringing this one health approach as we think about it, just to kind of summarize that in this slide, is we do look at this as a full circle of taking what we're doing on the production side with our natural resources on through consumers and the health of consumers in that. We hear a lot now about the food quality, food availability, food nutrition. We're developing plant-based proteins for many of these crops to try and bring protein, and we're an equal opportunity protein group, so we look at all the opportunities for that, but do we have ways, because manure, for example, from livestock and protein comes back as a regenerative component of our cropping systems, which people often don't think about with the nutrients that come from that, increases soil health. We look at the same things from plant protein that requires us to develop those into edible foods as we move forward. So with that, I will turn it over to an actual expert in the field, which I will confess I am not. I supervise a lot of this work and, of course, help to support it. But I'll introduce Dr. Jake Jungers and invite him to present. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Jungers. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thanks, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dr. Jake Jungers. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Agronomy and Plant Genetics at the University of Minnesota. And I am going to start by building off of Dean Burr's description of the motivation for regenerative agriculture and give you a bit more detail about what we're doing at the University of Minnesota in terms of both research and the teaching. So if we can move to the next slide.
Yep, I got it.
Thank you. I just want to highlight these three pillars of regenerative agriculture and talk about what we're doing at the University of Minnesota and why they're important for farmers and society. So the first thing is that farmers need more crops. We were all taught not to put all our eggs in one basket as youngsters, and right now farmers are kind of forced to do that. It's not one basket, but kind of two, corn and soybeans. And those crops are excellent. They're really important for our economy. They're very profitable. We do a very good job of growing those. However, they are vulnerable to extreme weather events, and they are vulnerable to geopolitical market shocks. And as we are seeing, this is really hard for farmers. So we're looking to provide more profitable crops for farmers to integrate into those rotations with corn and soybeans. And this has economic benefits, but also environmental benefits. And we're working with existing crops, many things you've heard of before, buckwheat, canola, but one of the crops that people are most excited about right now in Minnesota are oats. You probably have heard about this, a lot of enthusiasm around oats. There's been a lot of articles about the oat mafia in Minnesota. And this is great because there's an economic opportunity to get a third crop in the rotation, and it can be profitable. So right now, this is also spurring economic opportunities. We have a new oat milling plant that's going to go online this fall in Albert Lea. Very excited, farmer-owned, lots going on there. We're also developing the next generation of crops. So we're developing crops through the Forever Green Initiative, these winter annual oil seeds and food crops, winter barley, camelina, pennycress, you may have heard of those. Those fit into that relay system with our existing corn and soybeans. And the idea here is to help farmers take advantage of that asset of land. If land is sitting fallow for 6-7 months out of the year, it's not generating any income. So farmers can actually generate income with these new crops. They act like cover crops. They provide the environmental benefits, but they're also profitable. They're actually producing something that farmers can sell. So the winter annuals are really important, as well as perennial crops. Kernza, the world's first perennial grain crop, you may have heard of. I'll talk a little bit more about that, but that is a brand new novel crop, and right now the Forever Green Initiative and the University of Minnesota is not only creating this crop, like through the breeding and genetics, but also creating supply chains, markets, developing an economic system so that they are profitable for farmers. We're also very dedicated to those fundamental regenerative ag practices. Cover crops are still going to be very important, our classic ones. We want to make sure that farmers can employ those profitably. No-till is also going to be an important part of regenerative agriculture. And the last piece is reintegrating crops and livestock. One of the reasons we have these problems with water quality and degrading soil health is because we've separated these industries over the last 50 to 80 years of crops and livestock. By reintegrating those, we can use that manure as an organic fertilizer source, recycle nutrients, prevent those nutrients from going into our waterways, and producing more healthy foods. Then I want to talk a little bit about how we're doing this research. This research is not happening in silos, literally and figuratively, across the St. Paul campus. We are really interdisciplinary teams. Again, the Forever Green Initiative is a key to providing the tent of that interdisciplinary work, allowing us, fostering that opportunity to interact with colleagues all across these different disciplines. And that's what's really needed to move these systems onto the landscape and into the marketplace. We're also partnering with key stakeholders. We have businesses, small and large. Dean Burr described the relationships with some of the multinationals that we're working with, but we're also working with local businesses, bakeries, food processing plants. We are working with nonprofits, and fundamental to all of this is working with the farmers. We have to be making sure that we're getting the feedback from the farmers and deploying those resources to them profitably. And then this is really community-engaged research. I want to tell a quick little story about a research project that we did through LCCMR funds in partnership with Stearns County and the Ag Utilization Research Institute, AURI. We were doing this experiment to measure how much nitrate leaching we could have reductions from Kernza. And we planted a plot of Kernza on a high school, at the Ricori High School. So it was excellent because we had a FFA chapter there, high school students helping with the planting. We had local farmers donating their time and equipment to come and help with the planting. It was just a great event to showcase what the future of agriculture looks like. And then the year later, we had a large field day. We had probably 50 to 100 people from all around the community show up. We had speakers, Kernza of food products from local bakeries and beverage products. It was just a really exciting and I think really great demonstration of how we put the science to practice. Also want to talk about education. Now that is 50% research, 50% teaching appointments. So I spend a lot of time also educating and a core mission to the university. The CFANS provides the courses for the fundamental aspects of agriculture and regenerative agriculture. We have all the core courses for soils, for water, for plants, for society, But we also have these courses that synthesize these concepts into the new things like regenerative agriculture. And I teach one of these courses. It's Agro 1103, Crops, Environment, and Society. It has it all right there in the title. What's really great about this class is I actually get students from five different colleges across the campus, many who have never actually touched a corn or soybean plant before. And we have a lab in this course. So we go out into the field and collect biomass samples. We plant cover crops, measure cover crop biomass, actually get our hands dirty right on campus. And I just think that is such an essential opportunity for students. I also teach a course called Data-Driven Agronomy. Now, this is an upper-level 4,000 course. The goal here is to prepare students, the next leaders of our agricultural industry, with the tools to use data, to make better decisions in agriculture. And we are able to do this because of some really important assets at the University of Minnesota. So I mentioned the field plots right on campus. There are very few land-grant universities that have the field, full-scale farm field crops right in the back door. We walk from the classroom to these fields. It's just such an excellent opportunity. We also have access to these key industry leaders, and again, big and small industries, local co-ops to the multinationals. And we have ways to connect students to those leaders. So I'm an advisor for the Gopher Crops and Soils Club, an undergraduate club. We have speakers from these companies come and share internship opportunities with them. We also have a formal mentoring program through CFANS. We can pair up students with these leaders. Also, we're using the latest technology. We're at the forefront of using artificial intelligence to make decisions in agriculture with the AI Leaf Institute. That's just one example of many. And we're at the cutting edge to make this happen and to improve the lives of Minnesotans and beyond. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Youngers. And is there any member discussion? Chair Rarick.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. And we don't really get this opportunity very often in this committee to go kind of deep into something that the University of Minnesota is doing. But I do want to kind of put a bow on this whole thing because it is very, very relevant, not only that we support the state, not us personally, the University of Minnesota, but also we have a line item in our budget that's about, I don't know if it's 83 or 86 million a year. I'm looking at my He'll get back to me. It's somewhere between 83 and 86. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Savory.
Mr. Savory.
He knows what I'm talking about.
Madam Chair, I believe the reference is to the Ag Extension and the Ag Experiment Station, and combined, those two appropriations are $85 million approximately.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Rarick.
Thank you. So this is relevant to our spreadsheet, like everything I do is relevant to our spreadsheet, but that's 85 million is one of the larger line items that is a rider specifically to the University of Minnesota. So I really wanted to hear, and I'm sure you use funds from other places as well. You had mentioned LCCMR and other places that you're getting funding from. So I really wanted to dive in deep. I'm really glad you're here, and I do have one question that I didn't hear in your presentation, which is you talked about a lot of the different types of regenerative farming that you teach, and I'm wondering if you do the intensive grazing teach also, because you all, okay, so I'm going to turn it back to him so we can talk about intensive grazing.
Yeah, I think next week is our module on integrated crop livestock systems in my 4605 course. Yeah, and so that's the data-driven course. So we're talking about using fenceless cattle operations and the importance of rotational grazing to make sure you get the stocking rates right so that the animals gain enough weight and you don't degrade the land, core part of those courses. And if I could also make a comment about the funding, yes. I get a little bit more than half of my research funds from federal entities. USDA is a major supporter of our research program. On Wednesday, I have a grant due to SAER, Sustainable Agricultural Research and Education Entity. So I write a lot of grants for federal funds and then Forever Green Initiative and other state funds like MDA and LCCMR all come together to make the program what it is. Thank you.
Anything else, Chair Rarick?
Just really quickly, since we still have a half an hour, I'm not going to take it all, I promise. But this is of real interest to me personally. So my grandfather was a botany professor at the University of Minnesota for 25 years, was a nurseryman. My father was a nurseryman and an inventor. So it's the healthy soils and growing things is in my blood. And so this is of great interest to me. And in fact, a side note, my grandfather met his wife at the University of Minnesota. She was a student, so that would have been scandalous probably today. But and her name was Marion, so there you go, the tie back. But I also was wondering if you could speak just a little bit to the experiment stations. So we have two buckets kind of that in that $85 million for the biennium, and one is ag extension, which most of us know ag extension because it's in every community, and we love ag extension. They come and do all kinds of teaching to the public and things like that. But the experiment stations, could you speak to what that is? That's about $50 million of that third of $85
million. Dean Burr.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Rarick. The Agricultural Experiment Station is federal funds that are similar to the Ag State Special Funds that we receive from the state. And as part of that funding, there's a match within that that goes back to the origination of land grants and the public funding there. That funding supports the research infrastructure largely of the University of Minnesota. So, for example, when Dr. Youngers was talking about the ag research fields on the St. Paul campus, that's Agricultural Experiment Station funding that goes into that. We fund some salaries related to that through that funding. And then the 10 research and outreach centers are also part of that Ag Experiment Station funding. Much of our funding comes from, of course, tuition revenue, our research contracts, grants that fund much of the research that supplements that funding as well. One thing I'll mention about that, the Ag Experiment Station funding, that's national level. So for example, when we're talking about cover crops, we have partnerships with Iowa State University, North Dakota State University, Missouri. There's some in Georgia that we work with, for example, because agriculture inherently is this spatially dependent crop. What's the climate, what's the resource conditions? And that allows us to basically look at, can we extend this research across the country and make it available in the regions and different environments that are there. So that's a national level component that ties together the ag experiment stations across the country to do that work.
Thank you. Chair Rarick.
Thank you. So also, I'm really interested when you talk about healthy soils. I know that synthetic fertilizers and herbicides and all those things, you know, get into the soil, get into our food, and, you know, are bad for us. So I'm wondering if you have thoughts or you've got some cutting edge stuff to like reduce as much as possible the synthetic materials that go into our soils.
Dr. Youngers.
Thank you for the question. Yes, so the Forever Green Initiative crops aren't always pitched as organic crops, but the fact is that these crops, plants are on the landscape early in the spring when weeds typically like to grow. And that's when we have a lot of problems with our summer annual crops. The weeds are growing in the spring, and then we have to spray. So the idea that we have plants that are going to produce crops for us on the landscape and competing with those weeds, it actually suppresses weeds. And we've been quantifying that and measuring that value. So that is how one way we can reduce herbicides. I'm also quite a bit of research with organic agriculture. And we use our conventional kind of tillage approaches for managing weeds. Now, that has challenges because that's not great for soil health. You can degrade the soil through tillage. But we try to develop farming systems that can kind of optimize those benefits. We want to make sure we can develop systems that don't rely so much on the herbicides, but then also don't rely on tillage as much as well. And that's really the key for regenerative agriculture. And then in terms of nutrients, organic manures I'm really excited about because it synchronizes the supply and demand. Crops, if you just put a bunch of synthetic nitrogen on the field in the spring, that's not always the best time when the crop needs it. And sometimes when the crop needs it, we can't get the fertilizer onto it. So with an organic fertilizer, it can decompose throughout the growing season and synchronize that supply and demand. And we're doing very detailed research to like actually quantify how much nitrogen the plants need as they grow through the year and how much gets made available through different types of animal fertilizers. And yeah, we're just trying to develop these real tools for farmers so that they can do it profitably. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I think we'll go on to Representative Hansen.
Thank you. I don't ever get into this nerdy level of agriculture, but I do work a lot on cannabis legalization and its presence in Minnesota. And so when we're talking about soil regeneration and like carbon capture, that sort of thing, I'm always interested when this comes up. I've looked a lot at like Kernza being One of the ways we can do that, but we know that hemp can capture 8 to 22 times more per year. And so I'm just curious, in the future, once we have better kind of soil regeneration done, is that on the horizon at all? And I'm particularly interested because we know it's not grown a lot because there's not along manufacturing channels, you know, downstream. So farmers are like, well, who am I going to sell it to? We have to develop that side of the market. And you'd mentioned doing so for Kernza. So I was just kind of curious if that was on your radar at all, because that biomass is potentially, as we talked about, you were just talking about organic fertilizers, and we're going to have a lot of biomass as our cannabis industry continues to expand. So just trying to connect some dots. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Jungers.
Thank you for the question, Representative Hansen. Yeah, we're very interested in hemp, I'll just say it broadly. And we've done some experiments with it and actually quantified how much nitrogen leaching reductions occur in hemp as well as Kernza side by side of some different experiments. And we have some data just coming out probably in the next year or so on that, yeah. That was a multi-site study that took place at three of the different research and outreach centers, Morris, Lamberton, and well, the third one was not at a research and outreach center, but Central Minnesota. So utilizing that resource. But yes, one exciting thing that we haven't talked much about is how hemp can fit into crop rotations with those forever green crops, because hemp's planted later than corn and soybeans. And that gives us more time to harvest the seeds from maybe the camelina or the winter barley. So we can actually harvest those crops and then plant a later season species like hemp. This one is a great example. Buckwheat is another one that produces a really high quality, healthy food. So that's another exciting element that we'll be hopefully working on at some point with hemp.
Thank you, Representative Hansen.
Thank you. Count me in if you ever want to chat about it. I'm really interested in how we can, as this system builds out, just because we know that the carbon is, it's a problem with climate change, and we need to make sure we're doing all we can. So even if it's temporary, you know, to do that really quick carbon capture, I know that Kernza is more sustainable in that carbon capture, and hemp tends to be really good for like big immediate projects, you know, around sites with high concentrations. So that would be cool, and I would love to talk about like what does that look like in terms of building out and the industry side of it, from textiles to construction materials. We know that homes built out of hemp construction materials don't burn down. Like we can save money in some of these other aspects and make homes more sustainable and not from some of the more maybe cheaper construction products, but it does tend to be more expensive. And so trying to find the balance in that is something I'm interested in. So thanks.
Thank you. Representative Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a fan of CFAN. So every time that I go through that area, I see the students who are practically, you know, they're trying to get a good grip of the work that they're doing on the field. So Madam Chair, my question is, are we going to get an opportunity to do a field trip so that we can see?
That sounds perfect. I'm in. We'll work on organizing that, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. So we'll hopefully we'll have a site visit. Thank you.
Excellent.
Dean Burr, we'll reach out and see what we can organize.
Thank you. We're always happy to provide tours. As you can tell with faculty like Dr. Jungers, they're more excited to have that opportunity.
Thank you. Chair Noor, anything else?
It'll be fun to go join the CFANs.
Perfect. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chair Rarick, or whoever invited these folks to come in. It's I enjoy hearing about this, and Doctor, you're certainly enthusiastic about what you do, and I think that your students are pretty lucky to have someone teaching that is so enthusiastic. So, okay, I'm new to Kearns, okay, but I, you know, if you really wanted to sell it, you could have brought some bread made with it. Because it sounds good. I was looking it up, and it's like it's got a nutty flavor. And so talk to me a little bit about the markets that you're finding for that. Does General Mills, are they using that product? What else, what other markets have you found for that product?
Thank you, Dr. Jungers.
Thank you for the question. Yes, General Mills is a key partner, and you can go to any of the food co-ops in the Twin Cities right now and buy a Cascadian Farm cereal that says right on the front of the box, 1% Kernza Initiative. So you can buy it right now, and I actually had a bowl this morning, and I'm not even lying. Yeah. I know, sorry. So General Mills is definitely a partner, and they're helping provide international products
or national products. Patagonia Provisions is also a company that's partnering with microbreweries all across the U.S., and there are micro kerns of beers popping up all over the United States. Deschutes is a really large microbrewery that is key to that partnership. So if you think you'll like the kerns of bread, you should try kerns of beer, also very good. But one of the reasons that consumers are interested in Kernza is because of the health attributes as well. So it has higher protein than normal wheat, and that's pretty exciting and something that these companies are going to try to market. They're also interested in marketing the environmental benefits, saying that this is a healthy crop for the environment. Some consumers are willing to pay for that, but I think the health components and the nutritional aspects are going to be a key selling point for making sure that this works.
Thank you. Chair Scott?
Thank you. And kind of a fun question maybe for you. I don't know if you're currently a farmer, if you have your own farm or not, but if you were to go into farming today, or even just current farmers, what would you do? What's your number one, you know, what would you do?
Dr. Youngers.
Representative Scott, great question. I kind of wish I was a farmer, but then I couldn't teach as much. So yeah, that would be a hard trade-off. So I would definitely be trying to distribute my eggs in more baskets. I would be trying to diversify my cropping systems to really shield my enterprise from these crazy swings in our commodity crop markets. Commodity crops would be a part of my system, but I would just try to have it diversified. I'd have small grains, I'd have some forages, I'd make sure to have livestock on my farm as well, and so I could have a less expensive and fluctuating fertilizer source, mm-hmm. for sure. So those are probably some of the key things I would do. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that answer. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, there's this story that my dad tells, and he does have a scar on his head, but he went through a manure spreader when he was a kid, and he has a scar on his head. But I'm just going, it's just coming back. I mean, I don't know why we ever got away. I don't know why we got away from using that as a fertilizer. Maybe it's just, you know, I don't know. Maybe you can answer that question. But it just seems like that sort of thing has come full circle, and we're seeing the value in that again. And I don't know if there are any other practices that you've seen that used to be done and now they're coming back. Mm-hmm. And then that's my final question.
Dr. Youngers.
I think policy is one of the reasons why those have separated. This idea of economies of scale back in the 70s. And these policies maybe inadvertently kind of separated animals and crops. But we're fully recognizing that's an issue. And then your other question about other sources of fertilizer other than
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just like what else is coming back that used to be done as a practice? Like no-till's been around for a while, but I don't know how largely it's used, but it seems to make a lot of sense to me.
The one I will mention is intercropping, growing two species in one field. So almost all of our crops are grown as monocultures all by themselves. But especially the oat growers are planting a red clover with their oats. And that red clover is a legume, and it fixes nitrogen from the atmosphere and makes that nitrogen available to the oats. But not just the oats. The next year, they plant corn after that, till up that clover, and that clover decomposes and provides nitrogen to the next year's corn crop. And this is fresh on my mind because this is the proposal I'll be submitting next week to try to get funding to quantify what is the nitrogen credit from that clover to the corn. And it is super exciting to see two crops growing together in the same field. Clover has flowers. It can provide nectar and resources for pollinators, whereas oats are grass, so they don't usually provide that. So now you're having these resources for pollinators as well and providing biological nitrogen to the system. It's just... yeah, really cool to see this happening. And there are thousands of acres now in Minnesota with the oat clover intercropping.
Thank you. Chair Cleavon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you talked about integrating livestock and rotational grazing, which I thought was pretty interesting to hear. I'm wondering, you know, a long time ago, as you stated, we separated livestock from row crops. And I think moving those feedlots out also decimated some of our communities. Do you think bringing them back together again will help revitalize communities? It's just a question. Curious.
Dr. Younger.
Thank you, Representative Cleavorn. Yeah, I think so, because it resulted in this consolidation, right, and a reduction in that number of farms and enterprises, quite frankly. We've seen a reduction in the number of farms in Minnesota, and that's continuing to happen. So I do think that the reintegration and having these moderate size operations across the landscape, mm-hmm, would be good things for rural vitality, rural community vitality.
Thank you. Chair Claiborne.
Thank you. This will be my last question. And this question is going to probably be more controversial in the room, but I'm just curious as to what your thoughts are as leaders at CFANS. So there is legislation in the House right now to ban paraquat. I'll agree it's a nasty chemical, but it does have its uses. And then with the removal of Roundup or limited use of Roundup, right, we do have those really tough, noxious weeds. So when we're doing these intercropping systems, if you need to get something out to have a clean crop, what do we have available that's going to help us clean those fields? I told you it's not a popular question, but I'm really curious about what we do.
Dr. Youngers.
Yeah, thanks, Representative Cleavorn. That's a really tough situation that we're in. And I'd also add to the challenge is herbicide-resistant weeds. So we are running out of options for herbicides to control some of our weeds. We just saw an article about water hemp recently. So it is probably managing weeds is going to be one of the biggest challenges for farmers in the next few years. It's just one of the most challenging issues. And if we move away from herbicides, which in my organic research program we do, we have to use tillage. And that's not great for soil health. So these are these trade-offs then. And so we know that in certain fields, in certain areas, it might be less detrimental to use tillage. And certain areas, it might be more detrimental. Any land with slope or the soil type that can be easily eroded. So there we really want to avoid the tillage and maybe look at other herbicide options. And it's also up to, we know that markets and where markets are for farmers across the state vary. So not all farmers have access possibly to markets for Kernza, for example. It just might not be profitable to ship the Kernza right now to an end user. In the future, that's why we need to invest in like the supply chain development, things like that. So I think in the short term right now, we just need to get all the data we can and be really strategic about where we employ these different practices, but then create solutions beyond kind of the confined regimes we're in right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Okay, we talked about noxious weeds. Thank you, Chair. I have a question. You're here, so I have to ask, because I'm a gardener, and we're talking about weeds being the hardest thing to control. I mean, even in my little garden, I feel this. Number one, it should be illegal to sell thistle seed and bird seed. That's my new hot take right now. It is legal. And I'm curious if you have a take on that, because like quite literally, my neighborhood, we all like had a bunch of the same bird seed, and like our yards and our gardens have been taken over by this bull thistle or whatever it's called, and it is impossible to get rid of. And we're talking these things get huge, and they're spiky, and the kids can't play if a ball goes in there. I mean, we're in trouble. So I was just curious, while you're here, while I have you, you brought up the weeds, if you have any hot tips, even just for maybe not a commercial farmer, but just in our little garden in my little dead-end street, if you have any advice.
Thank you. And this is, a perfect example of why the Extension Service is valuable. So Dr. Youngers.
Thanks for the question. So you might not be able to do this in your boulevard or in your garden, but a farmer would plant alfalfa. It's a perennial crop, and it's cut 3 or 4 times a year. So during that cutting, you're knocking back that thistle, because the thistle is a perennial weed too, which is why it's so problematic. But the repeated cutting of that helps suppress it, and then the alfalfa grows pretty fast and compete with it. So what could you do in your garden? Probably find a fast-growing perennial or repeatedly cut it or dig it up. But it's a lot of work, and it's a problem for sure.
Yes. Representative Hansen.
I have found that tiger lilies do great. So this is what I, because they grow very fast and very big, and so that's what, so if anyone's trying, but you can't put tiger lilies everywhere. So I decided to ask. It's a pest in my garden, and I thought you were here, so thank you, Chair, for indulging me. I appreciate it.
Of course. Vice Chair Coulter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I was going to say this before Representative Hansen spoke anyway. I love how we're all just big, gigantic nerds right now. This is like, this has really just been one of these huge, nerdy conversations that we just don't have enough of in this place. This has just been so much fun. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. Chair Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to give you an opportunity to plug some of those awesome turf grasses that you have that maybe would help Representative Hansen.
Dean Byrd.
Well, we do have developed most of the turf grass, Madam Chair, sorry, apologies.
It's fine.
We have developed the University of Minnesota up in northern Minnesota. Magnuson Farm is a place we've developed. Many of the turf grass seeds you currently have that come through Home Depot and other places were developed right here at the University of Minnesota. I don't know specifically what type of turf grass would fight back bull thistle. I don't know if there is such a thing, quite honestly. But certainly using various management techniques around, you know, some of maybe herbicides just to, you know, as little as possible to get control and get rid of them, and other techniques of mowing, as Dr. Youngers was talking about. But a little known fact, we have developed many of those grass seeds that are northern seeds in particular in Minnesota. So,
thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Chair. I appreciate you. Could I count on your support to, if I put a bill forward next year to ban thistle seed in bird seed?
Oh, it is.
That's a real issue, and I think when I say it literally ruined our neighborhood's gardens, like I can't. It's such a silly thing, but it is affecting everywhere. And I imagine it's way, way, way worse for our farmers who are actually trying to make a living on this versus me and my just eyesore problem. But it is a real thing. So I would be interested to know. You don't have to answer me now if you don't want to, but just throwing it out there. Thanks.
Looks like we have some bipartisan support for that. So we'll look forward to further conversation. Is there anyone else who wanted to comment? Chair, I'm sorry. Before we go to you, Chair Rarick, Chair Scott had a question.
Well, this is a really important notion that I'm going to have here, but is there any research going on to genetically modify goats so they would just eat the weeds and the thistle?
Looks like we're onto something here. Dean Furr.
Representative Scott, no, we're not doing genetic research on goats manage thistle, but we'll take up the idea because we do look at all opportunities to manage these things.
Excellent. And Chair Rarick.
Thank you. I just thought I'd close this. I'm so glad we're having fun because it's our last like policy type hearing. And you know what? This place is tough and we've gone through a lot in the last year. And I'm really glad that we're enjoying this. And I know it's not the Ag Committee, but it's so critical to the state of Minnesota. And I wanted you to hear firsthand what the University of Minnesota is doing. And also I wanted to pitch the fact that we want to make sure that our ag educators, which is also a line item, it's a small line item, but we made sure we saved it, right, because it was kind of on the chopping block. Ag educator money is so important, as is a large animal vet loan forgiveness money. So I just wanted to make sure that we think about those line items. You know me, I'm always thinking spreadsheets. So those items are also really important, and you can hear now how important it is. And I appreciate that you've come and you've shared and you've gone beyond our expectations. And I think we absolutely, to Representative Nora's question, I think we should absolutely do a tour and go and just and see what you do. I would nerd out. I think half the room apparently would nerd out. So thank you all members for this incredible conversation that we've had. I'm glad that we're kind of closing on smiles on everyone's faces. Food is important to us all, right? So thank you, thank you, thank you. And thanks to the U especially for coming and sharing all of your knowledge with us.
Thank you both. Any closing comments?
Thank you. I appreciate the conversation. I always love a great conversation about agriculture and food systems, of course. And I'll cycle back to just the appreciation for the complexity of some of these issues and challenges that are out there. And so we're happy to have these conversations anytime. We try to address as many questions we have, but this was really terrific. So I want to thank Representative Rarick for bringing this to the attention of people, and there's some really exciting work going on here. So thank you for your continued support and efforts. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. With that, we are adjourned, members.